Hello and welcome to Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week we bring you stories on all things chemical, from copper to crucibles. Today we're exploring historical Jamestown, Virginia. We'll investigate how archaeology has revealed the birthplace of the American chemical enterprise and visit a modern-day glass-blowing studio. That's all coming up on today's episode of Distillations. Last year, tens of thousands celebrated the 400th anniversary of the first permanent English settlement at Jamestown, Virginia. This tiny peninsula on the James River was home to some of American history's most famous figures, including the intrepid Captain John Smith and the legendary Pocahontas. For the past decade, archaeologists have been sorting through millions of artifacts from the old settlement, resulting in the discovery of the original James Fort and the earliest glassworks in American history. This archaeological work has provided new information on how the early colonists lived and what they hoped to accomplish. But it's also raised many new questions. First up today, we'll explore one of these quandaries in our segment, Mystery Solved. CHF's Anke Timmerman has more.
Archaeologists at Jamestown have found thousands of copper pieces, apparently offcuts from the production of pots and pans. Historians already knew that the native inhabitants of Virginia, Algonquian Indians, valued copper above all other metals. It was worn by chiefs and high priests and could be used as currency. But the artifacts have raised tantalizing questions. Besides the offcuts, there were remnants of various laboratory devices: cupels, cups used for separating precious metals, alembics, vessels used for distillation, and crucibles with melted masses of copper inside them. If the colonists were just making pots and pans from copper, why would they need this chemical equipment? When the Jamestown copper offcuts were examined in the lab, archaeologists found that they were waste products of chemical manufacturing. But mysteriously, trace elements in the samples indicated that the copper had actually been produced in England and then transported to Virginia. Why were the colonists, who had limited room for storage, bring industrial waste to the New World? The answer can be found by looking at the key investors and backers of the Virginia colony. The same investors who backed Smith and his colonists were also board members of the brass manufacturing monopolies in England. By looking at their correspondence and records, we now know that colonists brought copper of known quality to Virginia in order to assay local ores and to find a suitable source of zinc. If you combine zinc with copper in crucibles under high heat, you get brass. England's zinc was high in lead, rendering the brass inferior, so colonists hoped to create a brass manufacturing industry with lead-free zinc in the New World. Mystery solved. I'm Anke Timmerman.
Anke Timmerman is an historian at the Chemical Heritage Foundation. Today, many people may associate the word strontium with the Cold War and the health threat of strontium-90, a radioactive byproduct of nuclear testing. The fallout produced by above-ground nuclear testing in Nevada in the 1950s scattered strontium-90 across a wide swath of American Southwest, including pasture land for cows. The cows ate the grass, children drank the milk, and strontium-90, which has a similar chemical structure to calcium, ended up in their bones and teeth, increasing cancer rates throughout the area. But recently, scientists have found a more productive use for other isotopes of strontium, particularly in archaeology. CHF's Audra Wolfe has more in today's Element of the Week.
The element strontium was first isolated by the British chemist Humphrey Davy in 1808, but it had first been identified in a lead mine near the Scottish village of Strontion a few decades earlier. In its natural state, strontium is a bright silvery metal that reacts strongly with air and water. It has a number of isotopes, the most common of which is not strontium-90, but rather 88. Two other isotopes, strontium-86 and 87, have recently been put to use revealing secrets of ancient and not-so-ancient civilizations. In Jamestown, archaeologists are using the ratio of these isotopes in teeth to help determine the identity of a young colonist who died under mysterious circumstances. The body, known as J.R., appears to have suffered a violent death, with a smashed knee surrounded by fragments of lead shot, suggesting that he may have been shot from behind. The written records didn't offer any clues, so researchers were left scratching their heads. Who was J.R., and why was he shot? Was this evidence of civil unrest at Jamestown, or was this possibly the body of a Native American? Archaeologists first turned to carbon testing in hopes of learning about the man's diet, and therefore where he'd lived most of his life. So scientists tried isotopic investigation with strontium, oxygen, and lead. These elements, taken collectively, can help researchers match a skeleton with the water supply that sustained it. The strontium tests indicated that J.R. came from either Wales or Southwest England. Historians have now taken over, turning to lists of immigrants and their original homes. At the moment, the best identification is one Jerome Alacock, but the reason for the mortal gunshot remains a mystery. Strontium analyses have now become universal in the archaeology of human remains, permanent evidence of the water we drink. And that's it for the Element of the Week. I'm Audra Wolfe.
For more on strontium and the mysterious JR, check out our website, distillations.chemheritage.org. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. One of the key chemical enterprises at Jamestown was glassblowing. And though few similarities to early settler life remain today, the art of combining sand, metallic oxides, and heat to produce glass has changed little in 400 years. Amy Mayer visited Josh Simpson's glassblowing studio in western Massachusetts and has this story.
Josh Simpson works in a dairy barn he converted to a studio 30 years ago.
If you go in my studio, it's like walking straight into a jet engine. You hear the sound of combustion, and you immediately feel the infrared heat of the glass furnaces on your face.
Propane fuels those furnaces. Simpson says early glass blowers worked over wood fires, but little else has changed.
Blowpipes were probably invented about 300 years BC, and glassmaking has remained virtually unchanged. It's a combination, a melange of metallic oxides, sand and metallic oxides, combined with extraordinary blinding heat.
Today, Simpson and three assistants weave around each other with careful choreography, wielding red-hot rods of molten glass. Rick Bardwell pokes a stainless steel blowpipe into a furnace and gathers a glob of the liquid glass. He further heats it with a blowtorch and then touches it to silver, which melts on contact.
I use silver to make incredible, sort of almost all the colors of the rainbow, from very beautiful peacock blue colors to yellow to gray to green.
Iron also makes green, cobalt makes blue, gold and selenium make a ruby red. Although it's chemistry that makes the colors, Simpson says getting the hue you want is no pure science.
With glassmaking, you kind of want to think that you're a chemist making colors. You really do. You want to think that if you add a teaspoon or a hundredth of a gram of one material that you'll get a certain result. But the truth is that if you want to be a glassblower, at least with traditional means, you really have to realize that you're not a chemist, you're an alchemist. And so you have to experiment. All the colors I've developed on my own have been throwing a pinch of this and a pinch of that and sitting there and wishing for it to come out well, and sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't.
When he has several layers of glass on the blowpipe, Simpson puts on heavy gloves and dark glasses and picks up a pack of wet newspapers.
And now is when the real fun begins, because I'll start to shape and form this molten blob, this molten sandwich, into a platter.
The glass makes several trips back into the ovens as he works. His assistants help Simpson transfer the work in progress from the blowpipe to a solid rod, leaving a small lip. That gets stretched and tugged and colored until it becomes the edge of a nearly flat disc. After some impressive waving to leverage the power of centripetal force, and then gentle sculpting with a wet wooden paddle, Simpson's platter sits finished atop its rod.
And that's it. It's all done. Kind of looks like a Hubble Space Telescope photo, doesn't it?
Now the glass is hard, but still intensely hot. It must cool gradually. Simpson cracks it off the rod and places it in a special oven. He sets the temperature to drop incrementally over 2 days. That's when the platter will be room temperature and safe to handle. Meanwhile, his assistants have prepped the next platter to be, and the dance begins anew. For Distillations, I'm Amy Mayer.
Amy Mayer is a reporter and producer based in western Massachusetts. You can see images of Josh Simpson's glass creations on our website, distillations.chemheritage.org. And that's it for this week's episode of Distillations. Today's quotation comes from Jamestown's founder and leader, Captain John Smith. History is the memory of time, the life of the dead, and the happiness of the living. Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbery Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indeviro, and our executive producer is Audra Wolf. Our theme music is composed and performed by Dave Kaufman. Please tell us what you think about our program and send suggestions for future shows to distillations@chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.